Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and young people, and thank you for coming out tonight to hear our Bible-based address to the title, Israel's Existence, God's Witness. To introduce tonight's lecture, we're going to take a reading from Isaiah chapter 43. That reading introduces our speaker for this evening, Mr. Dan Jolly, who will speak to the title, Israel's Existence, God's Witness.
Thanks so much for that. Introduction. Very warm welcome to you all. Thank you very much for having me here tonight. Particularly a warm welcome to our young people and our visitors, our friends. It's really good to have you with us here this evening to consider this really exciting subject. And I am very, very excited tonight. I have a bit of a confession to make. I've taken a different path through this subject to one I've ever taken before. And I guess a little bit of a disclaimer then for the young people and for the friends who maybe haven't been through this material many times before, or ever before. Tonight we're really going to be flying. We're going to be moving very, very quickly through our material. And as a consequence, I am aware that I may leave some of you behind if you haven't been through this material beforehand. So my apologies for that. Because this is one of the most important and profound subjects in the Bible. Israel's existence, God's witness. Back in the beginning, almost 4,000 years ago now, a man called Abraham, who lived in this ancient Sumerian city-state called Ur of the Chaldees in what is today eastern Iraq, heard a voice which he believed was God. Now this voice told him to do something that would utterly change his life, as we can see on the screen here. This is the first book of the Bible, one of the oldest book in the Bible, written probably by Moses, one of the servants of God, and he records how God spoke to this man in Ur and said to him, "Get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred, from thy father's house, to a land that I will show you." And Abraham was told to leave the country he lived in, that he was comfortable in, where he had his house and his mortgage and his car park and all of those sorts of things, and travel to a country as yet unnamed that God would show him. And God said, "For this, for your faith in me, I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you. I'll make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless them that bless you. I'll curse them that curse you. And in you, all families worldwide will be blessed." Well, as a result of what this voice told him, Abraham uprooted his family and his life, and he traveled westward across the ancient world, following the command of the voice of God. To start with, other than the belief that God had spoken to him, Abraham had really no other proof that God existed. But over the next 25 years, the book of Genesis records how Abraham would have numerous interactions with God. And these interactions convinced him beyond any doubt of the existence of the one who had spoken to him years earlier in Ur. These interactions would culminate for Abraham in the birth of a son in his old age, decades after both he and his wife had become completely convinced that they would never be able to have children together. And again, in his interactions with God, in his conversations with God, God reinforced the promise that he had first given here to Abraham. Not just that Abraham would have a family and therefore have a son, but that he would have so many descendants that his family would be a nation in their own right. Now, how many descendants do you need to have before you are a nation? Is it 500? Is it 1,000? Is it 10,000? When do you become a nation? And furthermore, God told Abraham that that nation would result in the blessing of all humanity worldwide. What an amazing thing. Almost three decades later, God spoke to Abraham again. And as we said, he repeated the promise he'd made to Abraham at first and extended it. He says, look, I'm going to make you very fruitful. You'll have lots of children. I'm going to make nations from you. Kings will come out of you. National governments. I will establish my covenant, my promise, my agreement with you, between me and you, and with your children after you, in their generations, for an everlasting covenant. God said to Abraham, look, this covenant, it's going to go on and on and on and on. It's going to last forever. I will be a God to you and to your children. I will give to you and your children the land where you're a stranger. I'm going to give you the land of Canaan forever. And just as I am your God, Abraham, I will be their God too. And so in addition to promising Abraham children and a national descent, God promised Abraham that he would give him territory, land, the land of Canaan. And in Abraham's life, God proved that he was not just a voice in Abraham's head, not just a delusion that Abraham thought he had heard, but actually a real, tangible being able to change the outcomes of Abraham's life. He was a being, this God, who was able to influence the future, able to predict what would happen in Abraham's life. And not just in Abraham's life, but far beyond. God predicted for Abraham that he would have a son, something that was clearly a medical impossibility, and yet he did. And then God predicted what would happen to Abraham's family down through the years. Just four generations from Abraham, in the time of his great-grandsons, his family had done just what God said it would. It had multiplied. It was fruitful. And they numbered in their hundreds, if not their thousands. And by the fifth generation, Abraham's family, now known as the children of Israel, a distinct racial identity, was so numerous that the most powerful empire in the Middle East at that time, the mighty Egyptian empire that built the pyramids, felt threatened by the size of Abraham's family. This is from the next book of the Bible, Exodus, and it says, the children of Israel were fruitful, they increased abundantly, they multiplied, they waxed exceeding mighty. The land was filled with them, the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh, this new Pharaoh, arose and he said, behold, the people of the children of Israel, they're more and they're mightier than we are. Just five or six generations on from Abraham, and God had been proved to be truthful. One man, and his family is a mighty nation that causes the might of Egypt to quake. And down through the years, this promise was confirmed and reconfirmed and reconfirmed. It is one of the great themes of the Bible, the promise to Abraham. Here, or almost 1,300 years after Abraham, a man called Micah, just like Abraham, heard a voice, the voice of God. And he wrote down what God said. In the intervening years between Abraham and Micah, Israel had grown into a nation. They escaped Egypt. They conquered the territory that God had promised Abraham, Canaan. They established a kingdom there before splitting into two states, a larger northern state called Israel and a smaller southern state called Judah. But now in the time of Micah, outside invaders, larger and more powerful than the Jewish state, were attacking it. And God told Micah that the nation of Israel should not think that they would be able to defend their state against these invaders. As we read in our reading in Isaiah, God was unhappy with the behavior of the nation of Israel. And he said, as a consequence, these invaders will succeed. In fact, God rebukes the twin states of Judah and Israel for their failure to value him, their failure to believe in him and only him. And yet, despite God's warning that the Jewish states would be defeated and ruined by these invaders, God reminds Israel through Micah of his promise to Abraham A promise that was repeated to Abraham's grandson, Jacob, promising Israel that even after their defeat by these outside invaders, he would not forget them. He says here, who is a God like unto you? A God who pardons iniquity, who passes by the transgression of the remnant of his heritage. He's talking about the bad behavior of his nation Israel, Abraham's descendants. But this God, he remains not in his anger forever because he delights in mercy. He will turn again, this God. He will turn again. He will have compassion on us. He will subdue our iniquities. He'll help us to behave better. And this God will cast all his nation's sins into the depths of the sea. He will perform the truth promised to Jacob. Jacob was Abraham's grandson. And the mercy guaranteed to Abraham all those years ago, which he had sworn unto our fathers from days of old. And here, some 1,300 years after the time of Abraham, the promise is repeated. Another 700 years or so later, another Jewish man, Paul the Apostle, was moved by God to repeat the same message that God had not forgotten his promise to Abraham, the same promise given to Jacob. He says here, look, I don't want you to be confused, everybody. Don't be ignorant about this particular mystery, lest you be wise in your own conceits. Don't get arrogant, he says. The Bible always said that God's nation, the Jewish people, would be blind to God's goodness. And they would remain blind to God's goodness until, well, he talks about a period of time, the fullness of the Gentiles become in, something we'll talk about soon. But he goes on to say, a time will come when the fullness of the Gentiles has come in, when all Israel will be saved, as it is written, there shall come out of Zion the Deliverer, who will turn away ungodliness from Jacob. And here the name of Abraham's grandson is given to the entire nation. And Paul writes of his covenant, God's covenant, unto Abraham when he will take away the nation and indeed the world's sins. Over 2,500 years, God repeated this promise, the promise to Abraham, the promise that he would make a special nation, who would possess the territory that we know of today as Israel. And that they would have terrible things happen to them, but that they would survive in the end, because no matter where they went and what happened to them, God would be with them in the end, and that they would return to the land that God had promised. You know, this history of interactions with people and of enduring promises made by God forms the foundation of the chapter that we read tonight, Isaiah 43. God says that he would save them. He would save them. And before we jump into Isaiah 43, I just want us to look again at what he says to Israel here in these verses. He promises that he would save them. He promises that he would fulfill his promise to Jacob. But in these same verses, he describes the descendants of Abraham, the genetic inheritors of Abraham's promise, the Jewish people, as both ungodly and as sinful and as blind. Blind. So let's turn now to Isaiah 43, our reading, and have a look at verse 1. But now, thus says the Lord who created you, O Jacob, it's the same language. Here God is using the name Jacob, Abraham's grandson, as a name to describe the whole nation of Israel. He repeats it. And he that formed thee, O Israel, fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have saved you. All Israel will be saved. I have called thee by thy name. You are mine. God claims to have made Israel the nation, to have created Jacob, the nationality. And in this chapter, in Isaiah 43, as in the quote in Romans on the screen, he promised that he would save them, even though they were, as verse 7 says, blind. Look at verse 7. Even everyone that is called by my name, he says, will be rescued, will be brought back from wherever they have been exiled around the world. For I have created this nation for my glory. I have formed them. I have made this nation. Bring forth, he says, the blind people that have eyes and the deaf that have ears. His nation were blind and they were deaf. And yet God would still rescue them, even though they weren't listening to him, even though they weren't looking for him. And so this passage, Isaiah goes on to say in verse 10, you are my witnesses, saith the Lord. You are my servant whom I've chosen. This is where our title for this evening comes from. And here in this verse, God is making a really interesting statement. He draws a picture, if you like, of all the other nations around the world and gathers them all into a room, as it were. And he, God, talks to all of these nations and he says to them, look, he demands them. He says, bring your gods, bring all of your gods into this room, all the national deities of the countries around Israel. And he says to them, all right, well, I want you, national gods of the Persians and of the Philistines and of the Phoenicians and all the national gods, I want you to do what I did. Prove that you exist by doing just what I did. Let all the nations be gathered. Let the people be assembled. Who among them and among their gods can declare this and show former things? Who can do what I've done, he says. He asked the other nations' deities to prove their existence in the same way he has proved his existence, by predicting the future of their nations. It's almost as if he turns to Asher, the god of the Assyrians, and to Ra, the god of the Egyptians, and demands that they demonstrate their ability to influence the future of their people, the Assyrians and the Egyptians, as he had done for Israel and was doing for Israel. And then turning to Israel in verse 10, he says, you are my witnesses. You are my servant. You're the ones I have chosen. And he repeats this thought again across the page in the next chapter. In chapter 44 and verse 6, he says this. Thus says the Lord, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts, I am the first, I am the last. Beside me there is no other God. I am the only real deity, he says. And who, as I have, shall call and declare it, and set an order for me, since I appointed the ancient people. Another version says it this way. He says, we'll just read it from here. He goes on to say, who can show the things that are coming and shall come? Let them show unto them. And effectively what he's saying is, who can predict the future? Who can take a whole nation and predict their history in advance? What nation can do that? What God of the nations can do what I have done? And he says, fear not. Don't be afraid, O Israel. Have I not told thee from that time? Have I not declared it? Have I not told you your future and predicted it? You are my witnesses. Is there a God beside me? There's no God, I know not any. And the point that God is making here is this. He's saying, look, my existence as the only God is proven by the way I established the nation of Israel, and their existence is a witness to my existence. He says, I predict the future of this nation. I declare future events. And my predictions, my prophecies concerning Israel are evidence that I am a God. Nobody but a God could do what I've done in predicting the future. Nobody but a God could do what I will do and save my nation in the way I will save them. And so that's what we want to look at for the rest of tonight. We want to fly through a few of those predictions and see how God made amazing predictions about his people's future and how they were fulfilled exactly as God said, and how that proves that God is God. So we'll start with a really little one, and we're not going to spend long on this one. This one's from Jeremiah the prophet. Jeremiah was a contemporary of Micah, who we've just read. And he received a message from God. His message was even more specific than Micah's, and even more grim. He said that because of Israel's failure to acknowledge him as God, the land of Israel that had been promised to Abraham would be emptied of Abraham's descendants. They would be exiled into foreign lands for a period of time. And what's interesting is that this prophecy here is very, very specific. It tells us who would do the exiling, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, tells us how long for. They would be exiled for 70 years. And when you think about it, to predict Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar as the nation to, if you like, conquer Israel, well, to be honest, anybody living at that period of time and having a subscription to a halfway decent newspaper would have been able to predict that odds on Nebuchadnezzar was going to be a problem. Nebuchadnezzar was the son of the king of Nabopolassar, who was, well, Nabopolassar ruled the rising star among the kingdoms of the time. The Neo-Babylonian Empire was definitely on the rise, and the Assyrian and Egyptian empires were in decline. And anybody who read a newspaper would have known that if someone was going to cause you a problem in the near future, it was going to be Nebuchadnezzar. So that bit, maybe not so impressive. But where he says they will serve the king of Babylon 70 years, that's quite a precise prophecy, isn't it? He goes on to say in Jeremiah chapter 29 that after 70 years of exile, the Jewish people would be released from their exile to return to the land of Israel. Quite impressive. And it happened. The dating is inclusive, which is why it looks like you're 1 year short there, but the captivity began in 606 BC and finished in 537 BC. 69 years exclusively, 70 years counting inclusively. 70 years until the Babylonians, who did conquer the nation that Jeremiah spoke to, were themselves conquered. And Cyrus the Persian, defeating the Babylonians in the same year, released Israel. And in Ezra chapter 1, verse 1, which we won't go tonight, commanded that Israel be allowed to return home to their nation. So that's just a little prophecy. God said and predicted 70 years of exile in a foreign land. He predicted that the land of Israel that had promised to Abraham would be emptied for 70 years. And it happened. Quite impressive. But I want to go to one that's, for me, much more exciting. Let's come across to Daniel chapter 8. Daniel chapter 8. Now, in Daniel chapter 8, a vision is given to this man, Daniel. Daniel's a contemporary of Jeremiah, but whereas Jeremiah spent most of his time living in Israel, near to Jerusalem, the capital city, Daniel was a very early hostage sent to the Neo-Babylonian court to placate the Babylonian kings. And so Daniel's life was spent in Babylon. And towards the end of his life, and towards the end of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, Daniel receives a vision, a message from God. He interacts with God, and God tells him something very particular. And what Daniel sees is he sees a ram rushing westward. Verse 4, I saw a ram pushing westward. And this ram is confronted by a very angry and very fast goat racing eastward. Verse 5, I was considering, and behold, a he-goat came from the west, so therefore heading eastward, on the face of the whole earth. That's telling us it was absolutely flying. It touched not the ground. It was just going. And the goat had one notable horn between his eyes. It's like a unicorn goat. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and he ran into him in the fury of his power. And the goat wins. The ram is killed by the goat. And then this the he-goat grows very, very strong. Verse 8, therefore the he-goat waxed very great. This is an amazing prediction. Because, you see, this prophecy was written towards the end of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, just before its defeat by the Persians. And you might think, well, why is that amazing? I mean, it just sounds like a whole bunch of gobbledygook with pictures and animals and strange stuff. But you see, Daniel is told exactly what this prophecy means. He's not left in any ambiguity. Verse 19. God effectively says to Daniel, behold, I will make you know what shall be in the last end of the indignation. At the time appointed the end shall be, the ram which you saw that had two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. Now, the empire that immediately followed the Neo-Babylonians was the Persian Empire, which was comprised of two, if you like, sub-empires, the Median and the Persian Empire. And the rough goat, he goes on to say, is the king of Grecia. The great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. And so what he's saying here is, look, it's pretty straightforward. That ram that you're looking at, that's the Persians. The goat is the Greeks. They're going to crash into each other, and the Greeks are going to win. And furthermore, the Greeks will be led by one preeminent king. He will be the one who will deliver them their victory. And history, of course, tells us that that preeminent king was Alexander the Great, a man who died aged just 32 years, having already conquered the known world. The he-goat, the goat, kills the ram and then grows strong, as we saw in verse 8. And the battle is won by the Greeks. This is something that would be completely unpredictable by the time that Daniel was writing. These events wouldn't happen for another 200, 300 years from the time that Daniel was looking at these events. Now, Alexander the Great was the Greek general who unified the Greek city-states. And he waged war against the Persian Empire, defeating it and claiming its territory around 330 BC. But on his death, just 7 years later, his empire would be divided amongst the generals. It wouldn't stay as one cohesive whole. And in the end, after many years of battle, four of the most significant generals would claim the lion's share of his kingdom. And we're told that in verse 22. He says, now, that being broken, in other words, the empire of the Greeks being broken, whereas four stood up for it, in other words, whereas the kingdom split into four kingdoms shall stand out of the Grecian nation. And none of them, it goes on to say, will be from the first king's power. None of them will be the descendants of Alexander the Great. Now, Daniel wasn't just given this really interesting historical vision so that God could demonstrate his ability to predict the future. Ha, I can write history books in advance. But this is not why this happened. This history here in Daniel chapter 8 was meaningful to Daniel and to God because of what the Greeks and the eventual successors of the Greeks would do within the territory of Israel, Abraham's land, and to the Jewish people, Abraham's children. Verse 11. This kingdom will magnify itself even to the prince of the host, and as a consequence, the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of the sanctuary was cast out. This was a prediction that at some point after Alexander's victory, a king who ultimately received his authority because of the authority built up by Alexander the Great would cause the worship services, here called the daily sacrifice, to end. And that king would take the place of the sanctuary, in other words, God's temple in Jerusalem, and cast it down. Some political descendant of Alexander the Great would throw down the temple and cause the daily sacrifices to cease. And Daniel was absolutely horrified at this thought. This is the point in the vision where Daniel stops and says, hold it, what are you saying? And in his vision, someone voices this very question for him. Verse 13, I heard one person, one saint speaking, and another saint answered that certain saint and said, how long will be the vision? How long is this vision going to last? The one that talks about the end of the daily sacrifice and about transgression and the sanctuary and all that stuff. How long will it last? And in verse 14, the answer comes. It's going to last for 2,300 days. Now, in the Bible, and in prophecies in the Bible, days are often put for years. We don't have time tonight to go through this in detail, but just one quick example. Ezekiel, the prophet, a contemporary of Daniel's, was told that he had to lie on his side for 40 days as a symbol of the years that Judah had been iniquitous, had been evil in the sight of God. And so a day of Ezekiel's life is put for a year of the things that God had to experience. So Daniel here is told that there would be 2,300, not days, but years. That would be the interval occupied by this vision of the war between the ram and the goat. It'll be 2,300 years. That's what verse 14 says. And then after that, it says, verse 14, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now, the word here, sanctuary, doesn't actually mean the temple. It actually just means the holy, and it speaks of the city of Jerusalem. And so it's saying here, the city of Jerusalem will be cleansed, but even the word cleansed is a little bit obscure. It would be better avenged. And so what Daniel's being told is that at the end of 2,300 years, the situation will change. And Jerusalem will start to get her own back. A prediction, ultimately, about, well, the history of the Jewish people. Well, some 220 years later, Alexander the Great, wasn't yet called the Great, that would come a little bit later on down the track, succeeded his father. He fought a series of wars to unify the Greek city-states, and in 334 BC, he crossed the Dardanelles out of what is Greece, traveling into what is today Turkey. And at a place called Granicus, he fought the first of three major battles that would result in the defeat of the Persian, remember the Ram Empire, here at this place in Granicus in 334 BC. The battle was fought crossing a river, and quite a significant battle, and Alexander the Great, of course, won. He won all his battles. That's why he was called the Great. And this is the starting point for Daniel's vision. This is the first point that ram meets the power of the goat flying across the earth. The first time the Greeks attack the Persians. 334 BC. And the question is, could God, the God who claimed to be able to influence the history of Abraham's people, the Jews in advance, could he influence an event 2,300 years distant from the point that the prediction was made? In fact, even more so. Could he do that? Well, 334 BC is our beginning point, and Daniel was told the vision will end 2,300 years later. It brings us all the way through. Feel free to pull out your phone and check my calculations. It comes through to 1966, and some of you will say, well, what happened in 1966? It must be big. Well, 1966, this particular beautiful Ford GT Shelby was released. There were a number of coups around the world. Three nuclear bombs were accidentally dropped on Spain. Not kidding, really happened. Vietnam War was in the middle of its raging. There was the FIFA World Cup. Toyota Corolla was introduced. All sorts of things. But none of them have anything to do with Daniel's prophecy. Nothing happened that year. But the next year, in 1967, an amazing war called the Six-Day War was fought by the Jewish state against numerous invaders, and they won against all the odds. They won. The newspapers at the time said bullets went round corners, and the video footage you're seeing is of Israeli fighters strafing Egyptian runways, winning an amazing victory such that in the end, for the first time in thousands of years, Jewish soldiers were able to stand in Jerusalem next to the wall that is all that remained of the temple. That image there. An amazing thing. A decisive victory. First time they'd been able to access that city in almost 2,000 years. And so they captured the city of Jerusalem, or in the terms of Daniel, they began to avenge the holy city, the sanctuary. Amazing. And so that's pretty neat, huh? So over a period of 2,300 years, this prophecy was accurate to within 1 year, just 1 year out over such a vast period of time. That's amazing. That proves God is real and he exists. Except our calculation was wrong. And some of you will know this. We're wrong because, you see, we calculated using 0 BC. We assumed 0 BC was actually a year, and it's not. There's no year zero. You go straight from 1 BC to 1 AD. And what that means is we have to adjust our calculation. It's going to take just a little bit more. 1966 was only 2,299 years into the prophecy. 1967 is in fact 2,300 years after the Battle of Granicus. Isn't that amazing? Over 2,300 years, God was accurate to the very year. He was able to predict the very year of the Six-Day War. The year in which Jerusalem, the holy city, began to be avenged. But you see, that's not all, because you see, the Six-Day War is also known as the June War, because it was fought between the 5th and the 10th of June. And you probably know this, but the amount of footage and video evidence we have of the battles of Alexander is extremely limited. And because of that, it's hard to date these ancient battles. People did not have phones to take videos in that time. I don't know why they didn't take them into battle, but they didn't. And so we've got no footage of these ancient battles. But it just so happens that for the Battle of Granicus, we have an unusual amount of information. And here's one of the records from the life of Alexander by Plutarch. And he talks about how Darius's captains conducted this battle, and it was across a river, and it was difficult, and it was unusual, and it's a bad time of year, and it all happened in the month Daesis. Just so happens we know when the month Daesis was. It straddles from about May the 15th through to about June the 15th. So the Six-Day War wasn't just fought in exactly the year that was 2,300 years after the beginning. It was fought in exactly the month that was 2,300 years after the beginning. God was accurate to the month, and I bet you if we knew more clearly when the Battle of Granicus actually was fought, it would be accurate to the day. Isn't that amazing? God is truly witness to by the fulfillment of prophecy in his nation. Isn't that incredible? Think for a moment of all the events that happened throughout those 2,300 years to the nation of Israel that could have prevented the fulfillment of that prophecy. So much happened to the Jews. There was the siege of Jerusalem in AD 70, in which as many as a million Jews died. In that siege, hundreds of thousands of Jews were sold into slavery in AD 70 when the Romans invaded the state of Israel as it stood at that time. There were so many slaves exported from Israel over the following years that the price of slaves on the Roman slave markets plunged. They'd give you away four slaves with every box of wheat mix. There was the persecution of Hadrian. The Jewish Encyclopedia says that it felt like Hadrian desired to annihilate the Jewish people. There was the Bar Kokhba revolt in AD 132 onwards, in which the entire central area of the land of Israel was completely depopulated of Jews, and more than 500,000 more Jewish people perished in that revolt. Flying on down through time, there was the Reich, massacre and the armed letter persecutions. One of them in which a mob randomly decided to go out into the communities of Rhineland and just kill Jews, as many as 100,000 killed in these various massacres. Or the armed letter persecutions in which a no-name general, actually used to be known, his name was Armed Letter, but he claimed to have been told by an angel to go and kill Jews. And he happened to have a mate who was a bartender, and he said he was a prophet and that he thought he should go and kill Jews too. And before long, there's a whole group of people out killing Jews, and they were so good at it that the army in the Rhineland couldn't stop them. 120 Jewish communities wiped off the map. Thousands killed, and these people, the armed letter persecutors, called themselves the Judenschlager, which means Jew slaughterers, and they were proud of it. During the Black Plague, the Black Death, the Jews were blamed for the deaths. 510 Jewish communities wiped out. In one example in Strasbourg, 900 Jews were burnt alive because it was their fault that the Black Plague came through. There was the Lisbon Massacre, part of the Portuguese Inquisition, a copycat version of the Spanish Inquisition. And what happened on that occasion? There were 4,000 new Christians. A new Christian was a Jewish person who had been converted at sword point, and they decided that these new Christians were not Christian enough, so they killed them. In fact, there have been literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of massacres and pogroms and persecutions of the Jewish state, Jewish people who have been scattered throughout the world over the years. And lest we forget the worst of them all, the Holocaust between 1941 and 45. This, an existential crisis above all others. And I have to say, as I worked getting these images up, I found it really hard to find a line between something that is needlessly grotesque and shocking and yet still show the grim and implacable and obscene normalization of the massacre of 6 million Jewish people. 6 million Jews. Hitler used Teutonic efficiency and modern technology to try to achieve what 1,000 world leaders before him, from Pharaoh in Moses' time through to Haman in the Persians' time, had failed to do. 6 million died, and Hitler failed to. Despite all Hitler's efforts, 3 years after the end of the war, 3 years, 2 weeks from the day that Hitler bit a bullet, in a bunker in Berlin, the state of Israel rose from the ashes of the crematorium. And following the adoption of the United Nations Resolution 181 on the 29th of November, 1947, the re-establishment of the state, initially inhabited by Abraham's descendants, located in the land of Canaan, promised to Abraham, was announced by David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister and the first national leader of the Jews in 2,000 years, 1948. Think about this. Of the nations of antiquity that surrounded the Jewish state in the time that these ancient prophets like Daniel and others wrote, nothing remains. The Assyrians, they're gone. The Babylonians, the Phoenicians, the Philistines, all of these nations are lost. Their culture, their people, their cities are found only in history books and museums. And yet Israel, the nation that God promised Abraham, the nation that he said would witness to his power, his existence, that nation, despite being relentlessly under attack, if you will forgive the generalization, under attack by the whole world for almost 2,000 years, that nation exists. In fact, it doesn't just exist, but it plays an outsized role on the world stage, doesn't it? No other nation has experienced so much persecution. No other genocide, and there have been many. Pol Pot's genocide, the genocide of the Armenians, the Holodomor, so many. But none was as severe as the Nazi Holocaust. None so long-term as the Jewish persecution for 2,000 years. And yet, despite this, Israel's contemporaries have faded into the history books, and Israel is daily in our newspapers and in world events. But back in Daniel 8, Daniel has a phrase to describe those centuries of loss for us. In verse 13, he talks about this desolation. Desolation. And it's a phrase he uses to describe those centuries of loss and of terror and of persecution. He uses this word, and it means something like to be totally numbed, to be stunned into a stupor, horrified by the destruction and catastrophe you're experiencing. Desolation. And in the following chapter, if you turn over, in Daniel chapter 9, God provides Daniel with further insight into this period of desolation that his people would endure. And in Daniel chapter 9, verse 27, he talks about this desolation. We'll start halfway through the verse where he says, "And in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease." And then he says, "And for the overspreading of abominations, he shall make it desolate. And even unto the consummation, and that determined shall be poured out upon the desolate." See, what Daniel is being warned here is that after the events described in Daniel chapter 8, in which the worship services and the daily sacrifice would end, he's being told after those events had occurred, there will be a period of terrible suffering for his people. Described here in this verse as an overspreading of abominations. Abominations, plural, which will desolate. As it were, a relentless wave or sea of abominable desolations that would crush Daniel's people until the time the punishment determined by God would finally be turned and be poured upon those who had desolated his people. A time would come until when the desolators themselves would be punished. The suffering would not be of unlimited duration, says God to Daniel. There would be an end, there would be an until. And the Lord Jesus Christ mentioned the same sort of thing, speaking of the suffering of the Jewish people and what they would experience, that the Lord Jesus Christ explicitly quoted Daniel and asked his apostles to turn back to Daniel and study it. And he said, "When you see Jerusalem compassed with armies, you'll know that the desolation is nigh." He goes on to say, "These are the days of vengeance. All things that are written, particularly in Daniel, will be fulfilled. You'll fall by the edge of the sword. You'll be led away captive. Jerusalem will be trodden down until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled." The desolations would continue until. And the question is, when would they continue to? Well, Daniel had already been given an answer of sorts until 2,300 years. But in Daniel chapter 10, 11, and 12, which are in fact all one big prediction concerning God's people, God provides further details. Further information. The end of the 2,300 years signaled the beginning of the avenging of Jerusalem, the holy city. But turn now to Daniel chapter 12, verse 6. Because here, once again, Daniel asks the question that is at the top of his mind. Daniel chapter 12, and verse 6. And I'm going to read from Rotherham's version because it helps a little bit, where he says, "And I, Daniel, said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream, 'How long till the end of all these wonders, all these things you've told me about in Daniel chapter 8 and 9 and 10, 11, 12, how long?' And he heard a man clothed in linen who was upon the waters, who held up his right hand and his left hand under the heavens and swear by God, the one that lives until time's age abiding. And the answer is, for a set time and times and a half. And when the dispersion of a part of the holy people is brought to an end, then shall come the end times of all things." How long will these terrifying things continue to happen to the Jews? How long? Well, he's told. Because the 2,300 years only mark the beginning of an end. A commencement of the saving of Jacob, not the full completion of the establishment of God's promise to Abraham. Abraham would be eventually the father of a nation in which all families of the earth would find blessing. When would that happen is the question. And he was given an answer. And we're not going to go through all the detail tonight for any of you watching the clock, but Daniel was told that after, well, time times half the time, 1,260 days, 1,260 years, the diaspora, the scattered of Israel, their scattering would be ended. And then the world would enter the time of the end of all things that were troubling Daniel. But as we read those verses, I hope some of you will go home and have a crack at reading them yourselves and thinking through them, you'll encounter a problem. In fact, there are two. Daniel was told in Daniel 12 and in verse 9 that these words were to be closed up and sealed to the time of the end. What he's being told here is that the ability to understand these passages, particularly Daniel 12, would be locked, as it were, sealed until the time when the 1,260 years had run out, had already been completed. In other words, this particular prediction could only be understood in hindsight, looking backwards. And secondly, Daniel was told what would happen at the end of this period of 1,260 years, but he wasn't told when it would begin. There's no start date. Unlike 2,300 years, he was told, there's the start date, here's what will happen at the end. In this case, he's only told what was going to happen at the end. That makes it difficult, doesn't it? How long will this 1,260 years, well, we know how long it will be, but when will it end, given we don't know when it will begin? Well, in Daniel 12, verse 11 and 12, Daniel is given two more. He's given two more time periods. It says, from the time that the daily sacrifice shall be taken away and the abomination that makes desolate set up, there'll be 1,290 days. And then he says, blessed is he that waits and comes to the 1,335 days. He's given two more time periods. And again, these time periods are challenging. As with the first, the 1260, so it is with the last one, the 1335. We're given no start date for the 1335. We only know what happens at its conclusion. It's only with the second of these periods, the 1290, that we're given an event that marks the starting point. And you'll see there that phrase that we've been talking about. We've encountered it before. It talks about a desolating abomination. In Daniel 9, Daniel was told by God to expect a flood of relentless, desolating horrors. But in this verse, the starting point is the establishment of one specific desolation. In fact, Daniel was told to look for a desolating abomination that gets set up, that gets established. So the word abomination, it just speaks of something disgusting. It's exactly what it sounds like. It means filthy. And specifically, it's something to do with worship, something that makes God's holy things unclean, something that defiles God's holy places, something that insults God's sanctuary, the temple. And in the last 2,500 years, there have been many things that fit that description. In 156 BC, Antiochus Epiphanes erected an altar to the Greek god Zeus on top of the altar of burnt offering in the temple. And then in 167, he showed up and decided he was going to sacrifice a pig on the altar of burnt offering. That was, according to Daniel, an abominating desolation. In AD 70, the Romans entered the temple precinct and burnt it to the ground. This too was explicitly called an abomination of desolation in the Bible. But here in this verse, Daniel 12 verse 11, we're looking for one that has an ongoing effect for a long time, for 1,290 years. And in AD 688, possession of Abraham's land now having been taken out of the hand of the Byzantines and placed in the hands of the Umayyad Caliphate, one of the Saracen Caliphates, Its fifth caliph began work on the Dome of the Rock, right on the site of the Temple of Abraham's God. Right in the place, in fact, of Abraham's most important and meaningful interaction with God, Mount Moriah. Now, the Dome of the Rock is currently Islam's oldest example of architecture, the oldest Islamic structure in the world. And it has stood on this holy site for just a little bit over 1,290 years. So we've got three periods. I'm trying to answer how long. Three periods, but just one start date. And given we've only got one, it kind of makes sense that we assume all three have the same start point. Daniel was told in the first time period that its end would represent an ending of the scattering of part of Jewry. Not all of Jewry, but part of Jewry. The end of the scattering of them. That's what it says. When the dispersion of a part of the holy people is brought to an end. And from 1260, if you add 1260 to 688, those of you who are good at maths, 688 plus 1260 brings you to 1948. We've already seen, haven't we, what happened in 1948. We've already seen it. The land promised to Abraham became a national homeland for the world's Jews. They welcomed the return of Jews from anywhere in the world, and millions did return. As Daniel was promised, the ending of the 1260 years has resulted in an ending of the part of the Jewish scattering. Daniel was told in the first time period that its end would represent an ending of the scattering of Jewry. So what does the next one bring? Well, given this was the time period linked with the desolation upon Jewish worship, the termination of the period probably has something to do with Jewish worship, doesn't it? And 1,290 years from 688 brings you to 1978. And unless it's your birthday in 1978, you're probably wondering what happened in 1978. The answer is Camp David Accords. In 78, the state of Israel, now led by Menachem Begin, which had been at war with its Arab neighbors since the very first hour of its existence, signed the treaty at Camp David with its most formidable foe, Egypt, led by Anwar Sadat. And this treaty would trigger a change in Middle East thinking, still being felt today. Its impact is seen in the Abraham Accords and warming relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia, but buried deep in the text of the Camp David Accords was a very important clause, one that promised freedoms for the Jews that they had not experienced in, well, definitely more than 1,290 years. This is the map of what the division of the land was going to look like under the Camp David Accords, but here's the section we're interested in. A letter signed and sent by Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt, and he says this: all peoples must have free access to the city, that is the city of Jerusalem, and enjoy the free exercise of worship and the right to visit and transit to the holy places without distinction or discrimination. You know what, at this point in time at which he's writing, the only people who had free access to the Temple Mount were Arabic. And he opened up the way. He said there should be a right of access to the Holy Mount for all Jewish people. And for the first time in 1,290 years, Jews were given the legal right, on treaty anyway, on paper, to worship in the holy place that had been under Gentile, non-Jewish feet for so long. Isn't that amazing? God predicted the life story of his nation. He predicted the date their state would start. He predicted the date they would get religious freedoms. He predicted the date of the Six-Day War. Over thousands of years, he's predicting the life of his nation, the children of Abraham. They are his witnesses. And God said that Abraham's people would be his witness, that their very existence would prove him to be God. And as we have seen, what other nation has endured what Israel has? What other nation has survived such desolation? But more than that, he said that the fulfillment of his predictions about them proved him to be God. And who but God could predict such unlikely events as a Jewish victory in the Six-Day War, the establishment of a Jewish state in 1948, and the promise of the opening of the Temple Mount in 1978. Such precision over such long periods. No one but God could do that. So as we wrap up, I want to look at one last prophecy, and I promise it will take 2 minutes. Ezekiel 38, 37. This prophecy is not dated, but in Ezekiel 37, verse 1, God says, he describes his nation as a valley of dry bones. And in verse 12, he says they won't stay that way. And he describes their national resurrection and that they would return to the land of Israel. That's an amazing prediction to make 2,300 years before it happened. Absolutely amazing. They would return to the land promised to Abraham. And Ezekiel 38, a prophecy that just continues from Ezekiel chapter 37. God speaks to a person called Gog, and he says to this person called Gog, a mysterious warlord from a distant northern nation, and he says that they will invade. And in verse 8, he says, after many days, Gog will come into the land of Israel against the mountains of Israel. And he predicts that they will invade the land of Israel. And then in verse 19, God says, I won't let that happen. I will respond in my jealousy, in the fire of my wrath. Surely in that day there'll be a great shaking in the land of Israel. God will intervene in this invasion of Israel. This is a prophecy still future. It hasn't happened yet. But the others all have. And the outcome of God's victory in this war against Gog and his army in Israel is told us in verse 23. It says, God will magnify himself and sanctify himself. He'll be known in the eyes of many nations. They will be a witness. Everyone will know that he is God. And so, it's good for us to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. For a time when Abraham's promises will be fulfilled, when there will be peace, and Abraham's family will result in blessings for all nations. We haven't explained tonight how that will happen. That's a subject for another night, but it will. Just as surely as God was able to predict the history of the nation of Israel, he is also able to predict the history of the world, and that history in the future will be a history of peace. But for us, there's something even more rewarding, because God promises that we too can become part of God's family and inheritors of Abraham's promise, as Galatians says. If we are baptized into the name of Jesus Christ, it doesn't matter if you're Jew or you're Greek, if you're bond or free, if you're male or female, you're Australian, you're American, it doesn't matter. We're all one in Christ Jesus. And if we are, we're Abraham's seed. Part of that promise, and we too can be witnesses to God.